one of the things we're very conscious of is that in the world family, in the global family, which God so loves, there are many people who are not eating very well or not eating at all, who are living under conditions that would just appall us. I realize that there are American tourists who may go to some of these countries and never see it, but if you have your eyes open at all, you do have to see it. We talk about the third world. Some cases they talk about the fourth and fifth world. Anyway, I think we start with that realization that all of us are aware that the gap between the rich and the poor is very evident, and that there are just very, very many people poor in the world, throughout the world, more in some countries than others, and also in the United States. I think we start with another realization that new things are happening in our generation among Christian people and even among Lutherans. And that is, I think that we're being a little bit more conscious of what's going on in other parts of the world than we were before. I hope at least that's the case. Earlier, when I was growing up, it was certainly part of my Christian upbringing that we had a responsibility to feed the poor. And I learned as a child to contribute to causes that would send money somewhere to relieve hunger. And I remember as a child during the Depression days when there would be what we used to call hobos in those days who would come to the door. My mother would see somehow or the other that there was some food for them. I mean, I grew up with that, and I'm sure most of you did. The idea that feeding the hungry is a Christian responsibility. But I think a new realization is that it's not just feeding the hungry. It's maybe trying to understand something about the situations that cause hunger. In the manifesto that we referred to last night, for those of you who were here in the ALC manifesto, there is a statement that we strive to relieve world hunger, nothing new, and to deal with its causes. That's new in church thinking. That's something new that's happened during my lifetime. One story which I quoted in a similar forum, a similar discussion like this last week, some of you may have read in Dick Gregory's autobiography. He tells how, this was in St. Louis, I think, where some good-hearted church people came to bring a Thanksgiving basket, maybe it was Christmas, I don't know, to this poor black family in the slums. And so in the generous Thanksgiving basket from the loving Christian people was a frozen turkey, and they deposited all this fine food with the poor black family. Well, no one of the kind-hearted Christians ever checked to see whether or not this black family had any way of cooking the turkey, because their utilities had long been cut off for non-payment of bills. So that kind of giving, you see, what good does a frozen turkey do if you can't cook it? I mean, that kind of giving, I think we go to a new stage of consciousness now if we try to understand the situation in which the hungry people are, and to try to understand maybe some of the causes and to see maybe how we are involved with that. Now, there are many new understandings, and I don't want to go into a lot of detail on that either. Those are other topics. I think new understandings that are coming to some of our Christian people, even hard-headed Lutherans, is that it is not that people are poor because they're lazy. Some of us grew up with a work ethic, the idea that my ancestors came to this country, they really had nothing, they came with nothing, look, they worked hard, they made it, they did all right. So why don't those other people in those other countries get on a stick? Why don't they do it? And I think that kind of judgment is something I hope we're getting beyond, to realize that the situations are so different. Also in this country, for some people who are here, some of the people who are here didn't choose to come here. Their ancestors were brought here as slaves and so on. I think we're realizing that other countries have different histories, different geographic factors, and so on. So I think we must try to understand a little bit about other countries and not just say, well, you know, they just work harder, or we made it, why can't they? That's simply ignorance on our part. I think that's ignorance. And that's why I'm very concerned about trying to understand a little bit more about other countries and why they are in the situations. There are no easy answers. There's no one answer as to why is there poverty in Colombia or any place else. It's very, very complex. All right, so the need for understanding. Then I think another thing that's happening to us as Christian people that is new, at least for me in my life, it's happened in my life, is the realization that our affluence, our prosperity, which we sort of take for granted, we work for it, you know, we're a blessed, we're almost a chosen people, you know, we can afford to share with other people. I think the new thought is that our affluence and our prosperity is tied in to poverty in other parts of the world. That is not saying that because we are rich, other people are poor. Except that sometimes there may be some truth in that. It's not the whole ball game. We're not the cause of all the poverty in every country in the world. No way. But there are actions of our multinational corporations, maybe of our government, maybe of our lifestyle and our demands, my demands and your demands as consumers, that do tie in with the lives of people in Costa Rica or Guatemala or Africa someplace, somewhere or the other. We're tied in with all of humanity. The ecological thing that we've been hearing about the last couple of years, I think, brought that to our attention. That you can't just separate what happens in one country in the world of nature. Like if China decides to test nuclear weapons above ground, some of the stuff, some of the fallout, and so on and so forth, is going to be carried by winds that go around the earth. And if there's an oil spill from a Liberian ship someplace, the pollution may affect somebody else's coastline. I mean, what one country does make a difference in the world of living things. If one area is fished out in an area, that whole factor may affect lives in many different countries. Joe Sittler's reference to the whole creation as a spider web, like a spider web, I like that. He says, you touch one part of a spider web and the whole thing quivers. And I think we've learned that about our natural world, that the natural world is finely balanced ecosystems. One thing is tied to another thing. So if there is gross pollution or if there is depletion of something, if the tropical forest in the Amazon basin is continuing to be cut back and so on and so forth, it may affect oxygen supply. It's all tied in with everything else in the natural world. All right. The same thing we're realizing now is true as far as people and human activities. It does make a difference what happens in another part of the world. Exhibit A, of course, has been the oil crisis. At last, I think we're beginning to realize we talk about being self-made people. Well, we are not self-sufficient. There is no way we're self-sufficient. If you look at all the stuff that you use during the day, the things we eat, the pencils, the paper, pulp probably comes from Canada, some of the metal in the pencil probably comes from someplace else, the aluminum foil, probably the bauxite came from Jamaica or something. I mean, every bit of material we use, somehow or the other, is tied in economically with the rest of the world. And we never really thought about that until we started hurting a little bit as far as our oil is concerned. And we've been mainly crying about what it's doing to us. I mean, how are we going to get along with this high-priced gasoline or with less gasoline or turning down the furnaces even more or turning on the air conditioner even more or whatever. And we haven't thought too much about, meanwhile, what's going on in the countries where the production is going on. We've thought mainly about us and supplying our needs. And now we begin to realize that because maybe we want a certain kind of product at a low price from another country, that may make a difference in the lives of the people in the country from which it comes. Have any of you been in Jamaica? I have not, but I have family members who've been in Jamaica, and they say the other side
of the pretty tourist parts is appalling, because Jamaica is just gouged out, pitted, where all the bauxite ore has been taken out. Now, bauxite is the main raw material for aluminum. And I don't know what I do without aluminum foil in my kitchen. And, you know, we just sort of take cheap aluminum foil for granted. But bauxite, the raw material, we do have some in the United States, but not a whole lot. I mean, a lot of it is in Arkansas. But rather than gouge out the hillsides of Arkansas, we gouge out the hillsides of Suriname, South America, or Jamaica, or someplace like that. I know it comes into the Texas coast at near Corpus Christi, and you can see the huge piles of it that come in. So the people who are sensitive to that will say, well, when you look at the back country in Jamaica, it's just awful, the landscape. I mean, these big gouged out kinds of things, you see, what's happening to their environment. But because I like aluminum foil. So you see, I am tied in a little bit with that. You might say, well, doesn't it give the people their jobs also? Yes, but we like to have it as cheaply as possible. And here's where the corporations come in and so on and so forth, that very often the country that is exporting a raw material or a certain food product that we can't raise here economically is doing it under a situation where a few people control what's happening, where many people do the work at very low wages. Some of you have heard my banana story, but bananas are a good illustration, and also Ron Sider has a good chapter in this book, which I'll talk about later, why bananas are cheaper than apples. When in January I took a group of students to Hawaii, when I left Seguin in January, bananas there were 25 cents a pound. I mean, it fluctuates, so that's dozen, 29, something like that. Bananas in Hawaii at the supermarkets on the same island where they were raised were 39 cents. Did you price any there, Doris? Something like
that. We noticed that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the same thing with pineapple. We could get pineapple cheaper in California than we could in Hawaii.
Now, isn't that interesting?
That
see? All right, now the point is these were Hawaiian bananas raised in Hawaii, and they've got the climate for it. But they were selling, they were much more expensive right where they are raised. Okay, now Hawaii is a state of the United States. So that means that certain minimum wage laws apply for agricultural labor. The bananas I buy for 25 cents or 29 cents, no telling what they're now, are from Costa Rica, maybe Mexico, but someplace in Central America, where cheap labor is cheap enough there, that not only can the big growers, pay that, raise them, but they can afford to ship them, fly them in to my area, and I can still get them a lot cheaper than I could home-raised bananas, let's say, in Hawaii. Now, what's wrong with that? Isn't that employing a lot of people? Yeah, it is, but it's not as simple as that. Because the story of the economic development of a lot of countries, particularly I'm talking more about Latin America, though many of these things apply to Africa, but I know a little bit more about Latin America, I'm still learning, is that in their history, they were geared for producing maybe one main crop or a couple of main crops like sugar cane. Sugar was one of the first. Later on, bananas, coffee, and things like that, which the mother country, originally Spain or Portugal or something, could not raise. So what we call plantation agriculture is the system in which the capital comes mainly from the outside, in which there's emphasis on producing maybe one main crop. That one main crop is for export. You do it on a large scale, so that means you need a lot of labor and a lot of cheap labor. But it generally means that the people then who maybe were living at subsistence, were eating, were making it on their own little farms, maybe their own little parcels of land sometimes, now are working for wage labor in a lot of cases. All right, so they're moved off the land. They really have no land of their own. Okay, so here is a country's economy is tied up in maybe a couple of exports. In Latin America, about 10 years ago, some countries had maybe 70% of their income coming from one or two things that they sent out. It varied from country to country. That means you've really got all your economic eggs in one basket. Well, if on the world market the price fluctuates just a little bit, Like if American women decide to go on a slimness kick and not use as much sugar. Sugar is not as much in demand, and so things happen to prices and so on. And so when the price fluctuates on the world market, that means maybe that there's not as much need to produce, to grow as many bananas or to grow as much sugar or something. So a lot of these poor people then, who are the wage laborers, well, they'll be unemployed for a while. And so they go to the cities, and so the slums of favelas keep growing and so on. All right, now that seems like a very complicated thing, but I think there's all kinds of evidence that the rise and fall of the market and so on, depending on our consumer demands and of other Western countries and so on, is pretty closely tied in with how well people live and eat in, let's say, the third world. And the other factor in there is that the control of that whole thing is in the hands of a very few. There are three U.S. companies that control 90% of the banana production. So it's the big corporations. Now, some of the big corporations probably have gone in with good intentions, what we call the multinationals. Certainly there are good people working for them, but there is a lot of evidence that sometimes the big corporations also may cause more problems maybe than they do good. I'll give one more illustration, which a few of you have heard. Peru is one of the countries where canned milk is used much more than fresh milk. There is one company in Peru, Leche Gloria, S.A., which controls 86% of the evaporated milk and 50% of the fresh milk. Now, the fresh milk, a lot of the fresh milk, then goes into, I don't know, whatever, you know, to turn it into powdered milk or however they concentrate it for canned milk. Now, the Peruvian government supports this kind of thing, the canned milk, rather than encouraging production of fresh milk and trying to set up more distribution for fresh milk. I realize, of course, they have transportation problems, so in some cases canned milk makes more sense maybe than fresh milk. I mean, that's obvious in a lot of countries because transportation is a real factor. But apparently the encouragement is towards the canned milk. Now, that sounds very fine, but for canned milk, the thing that costs the most, really, some instances, is a can. That's important. And so is a lot of the powdered milk that they mix with it. So that a large part of the stuff is imported. And the company that is Leche Gloria is the Spanish name for carnation. So that here is a corporation, U.S.-based corporation, which has a lot to say, a very great deal to say, about the cost of milk in another country. The present government is supporting the work of this corporation. Of course, it has a local name and things like that. And with Peruvian inflation, the price of milk has gone up just astronomically, so that a lot of babies just aren't getting any milk at all. I mean, people can't afford it, and so on. It's very complicated. What I'm saying is that we, from our economic side, the corporations in which, you know, we buy their products, or the government policies in some case, like if one of our corporations is sort of attacked, or in another country, we sort of rush the military in there to protect our economic interests. We are tied in with the rest of the world. All right. But that's very complicated. And there are good books on that. Barnett and Melder's Global Reach is not in the bookstore here, but if you're interested in the work of the multinationals, that's probably the classic and one that has a lot of documentation on that kind of thing. Now, because we're tied in with the rest of the world, maybe we can't do too much about the corporations, maybe we can't too, or the political thing, but I think let's start this morning with looking at ourselves and what we consider important in life. We can't save the world. That's obvious. Even if we, you know, live very, very simply, we cannot feed the rest of the world. By the way, we like to think of the United States as a global Santa Claus. We're always helping everybody, and we have a good self-image, and many people realize that American people do like to help. you realize we're only number 13 in the list of countries in terms of the foreign aid that we give that helps people directly. You know that, don't
is that,
you?
Is that just what the government gives, or does
right.
that include
that's,
the
no,
church
this is
in
government.
This
is government. This is government, right. But in terms of direct government aid that goes to help people, I'm not talking about sending them weapons, but in terms of the percentage of our GNP, gross national products, we're number 13 on the list.
But if we included the church,
oh, right.
wouldn't
that's
that make
it another story. The churches make it look a lot better. Right. But still, statistically, in terms of our gross national product, even if you put all of those things together, when you think of how much we have, the proportion which we give away is still very small. We're not that generous, but the government program is, you know, number 13. Now, giving away is really not the approach. I mean, because I think we're more geared, it's more important to get involved in programs that help people help themselves, because, you know, just giving puts people down. I mean, if you know, this is this bountiful thing, you're handing things out to other people. I mean, I think the approach has to be more self-help for development and so on and so forth, and aid. But even though we may feel pretty generous, and through the church we've learned to give, and we've learned to give sacrificially, I think we need to look at ourselves and how we live in terms of the hungry world. Have any of you seen the film, The Glass House? It's used sometimes in World Hunger Consciousness Raising. I've used it also with students. It's a Swedish film with English subtitles and produced in Sweden. And it shows an affluent person, Western-style person, living in a glass house with all the hungry people here. And you see the people outside. I mean, it's really the glass house. And in effect, we are living in a glass house, because with television or with movies that are exported and so on and so forth, our movies usually, you know, show you know, our life, affluent lifestyle and so on. We are becoming more visible, and most people think we have, maybe they have, think we have three cars in every garage and a boat and so on, so sometimes the picture is grossly, you know, exaggerated, but still, in contrast, other parts of the world are learning a little bit more about how we live. Now, so how do we handle all of that? The biblical picture seems to be that God's intention is that all should eat. Have you ever used this as a table grace? The eyes of all look to thee, and thou givest them their food in due season. Thou openest thy hand and satisfiest the desire of every living thing. Have you ever used that? Psalm 145. Thou satisfiest the desire of every living thing. Is that true? Is it happening? Yeah, you see now, there's something that's got to be a little upsetting about that. Psalm 107, oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he's good, his steadfast love endures forever, and so on. For he satisfies him who is thirsty, and the hungry he fills with good things. Now, do we just spiritualize that, you see? Well, now, has God gone back on promises? Or isn't God doing his thing? You see, why aren't the desires of every living thing being satisfied? It's obvious they're not. Or is it something about distribution and people and people's stewardship of resources in the earth and distribution? One of the best things that's come out, I think, in print, and I didn't bring my copy with me, is a little leaflet from LCA, The World Can Feed the World. And it makes the point, and I'm becoming more and more convinced of this geographically. I think 10 years ago, 5 years ago, there was all this gloom about there's no way that the earth can feed the population it has or the growing population. I think I'm reading in geography sources, which are not raising theological issues at all, that the earth can feed its population. It's how we use our arable land and how we distribute what is raised This is what I'm coming to feel. Yes, the earth is finite. And it doesn't mean that everybody can eat the way U.S. people eat, or everybody can use energy the way we've been using it. No way. But that for living, and maybe a cut above subsistence, the earth, the world can feed the world. And I think there's some evidence coming in to
what
that.
What do you think of the Bread for the World program?
I support it. I'm a member. I think this is saying that this, and since you mentioned that, this is one of the things that Arthur Simon said originally in this book, which is in the bookstore. Now, the statistics in here are a little out of date, but the trend of the statistics and the ideas, I mean, are still very, very pertinent. So if you don't know this classic, this is one you really should get acquainted with. I think it came out in 74, but the movement that Arthur Simon, 75, the movement that Arthur Simon, who is a Lutheran clergyman, started has become a national citizens' lobby, particularly for causes that will support programs of grain surplus, that will support government programs that help other countries in self-development rather than just sending them weapons or something like that. It is not exactly supporting military aid programs, in fact, to the contrary, food programs and so on. And an interesting thing I learned last year at an area Bread for the World meeting is that most of the members now are Roman Catholic. In other words, the largest single group represented in Bread for the World membership is Roman Catholic, which is sort of interesting, that it has become very, very ecumenical, and people of all creeds begin to realize here is one small way in which to lobby for causes that help reach up. I believe that the biblical picture is that God's intention is that all should be fed. But the biblical picture also shows us some condemnation of those who take more than their share. You know the Exodus story, the manna in the wilderness? Surely you're familiar with that. And it says that, you can look it up in Exodus 16 next time you have access to a Bible. And always there was enough. In other words, those who had enough, where is it? You take enough, the people did so, they gathered, some gathered more, some less, when they measured it. He that gathered much had nothing over, he that gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what he could eat. And the people who took more and were going to, hey, keep it over. You remember what happened to the manna? It got worms in it. Right. Now, however you want to take that. But it sort of seemed to say, all right, enough is enough. And if you're going to store it up, it's going to get worms in it. The idea. You go through the prophets. There's some beautiful passages in Isaiah. For example, 58, 6 through 7. Is this not the fast that I choose, to loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, bring the homeless poor into your house, and so on? Oh, the prophets are full of reminders that it's pretty important to think about sharing. Just read Amos sometime. Amos really blasts the people who were living high and who did not have a social consciousness. Or 2 Corinthians, Paul is talking there about this offering. This is in the 8th chapter. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Something about the giving. I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened. In other words, by their giving and the collection. But that as a matter of equality, your abundance at the present time should supply their want, so that their abundance may supply your want, and that there may be equality. It, as you get into Scripture, it seems to be God's idea that everybody should be eating, and that equality is a little bit more of God's idea than maybe we're comfortable with. That gets into a whole lot of other issues, political, social organization, and so on and so forth, and I want to touch that this morning. But from a very practical viewpoint, if we realize that we're living in a glass house,
that even brothers and sisters in Christ are not eating, and that we as a nation have much more than most others. Does that do anything to us? Even secular forces are saying something. One of the essay writers for Time magazine, now that's not a church publication, Lance Morrow, in the issue of June 4th, has this remarkable article on the weakness that starts at home. And it is talking about zooming around in power boats and all of this, and then making the statement someplace along the line that Americans are the most wasteful people who have ever lived on Earth. Now that's Time magazine is saying that. The most wasteful nation, the most appallingly wasteful people. Whole nations could live comfortably on their leftovers. And that's quite a statement for a secular magazine to make. I think the first approach in practical living has got to be something about attacking waste. I think it begins in the home. I think it begins in feeding children. And I know a little bit about trying to get children to clean their plate. And of course, part of it is don't put too much on in the first place and so on and so forth. But if you've ever worked with a school cafeteria or have seen what happens in school cafeterias, statistics say that 1/4 to 1/3 of the food there goes to waste. I think we have a real challenge. Most of the people here this morning, it's not the women's job alone, it's the men's job, because men sometimes set an example, negative or positive, in how they eat. So it's parents, it's in homes, whatever. Attitudes towards food and waste that I think are basic. Those are things you start with very young children. There's a lot of waste that happens at Holden here, and I know sometimes, you know, I know a child, I'm going to drink the whole glass of milk, then they just barely touch it, but it gets poured out. I mean, I know kids, and you struggle with that, and it's an effort all the time, isn't it? I mean, too. And just telling them, think of all the hungry people in the world, you tell the child, clear the plate, makes no difference, because how's that food going to get to the hungry people anyway? It doesn't. But I mean, just the attitude towards waste is a very important one that I think a lot of people have missed. What about things like, have you seen the TV commercials on dog food for overweight dogs? Dog food for overweight dogs. I have a sensitive daughter-in-law who says, that's obscene. When you think about starving people, that a big worry is a dog getting too fat? See? So the attitude towards waste, whether it's resources, as a classroom teacher many years ago, I know, you'd see children start to write on a piece of paper and, you know, make a little mistake, the whole clean sheet gets ripped up and thrown in the wastebasket. Not in my classroom, even 30 years ago. Because there's something about an attitude. That was from a tree, it's wasting resources.
Well, when I started working with the lab school, that was in the early 60s, I was concerned about teaching the four-year-olds ecology. So I asked Rudy, I said, how can I go about teaching these four-year-olds? He says, first thing you do is teach him to write on both sides of the paper.
Precisely.
Something they can understand.
Yeah. It's interesting how many college students come in from high schools thinking that they dare not touch the back of a paper. Not use both sides, because they've been told use only one side. And I will always turn in reading cards, reading reports. I will always, on the card, I tell them, but then they forget. I said, use both sides. Save trees or something. But those are attitudes. All right, now that was the thing. Food habits in terms of what we eat, not just wasting. Holden, as you know, does not serve you much meat. That is on purpose. And I think you can be very, very well nourished at Holden. And without necessarily hitting the snack bar every night. Whatever. Meat consumption in the United States, most of you know, is
enormous in comparison to the rest of the world. Some statistics say it's 110 pounds a year, whatever statistics you take. You do not need that much meat for nutritional well-being. And particularly the habit that is in this country, it's a part of the way of life in Texas, and I say this in Texas, it doesn't make you too popular, is using grain to fatten beef or pork. Now a cow, beef cow, is a very efficient animal at changing grass, which people can't eat, into meat. So range-fed cattle do a pretty good job of using land maybe that might not do much else. But when you use good land, agricultural land, to raise grain or corn, or I mean what, some kind of a grain, just to fatten an animal, then to make it taste better according to some taste. And by the way, a lot of the tasty stuff goes into the fat, and the fat you don't eat anyway. It just sort of, you know, gives the flavor when you're frying it. That is a very poor use of land. It's getting a very low yield out of potential protein. And there are figures on how many acres, you know, it takes and all of this kind of thing that if you're interested. Some of those are in Bread for the World. I think we need to say more about that. I believe the message is getting through, because have you seen the ads in the magazines, like in Time? You've a right to like red meat. Have you seen that? The meat producers of America are putting in ads. You've a right to like meat, because apparently some people are feeling a little bit guilty about eating a lot of red meat that maybe has been grain fed. All right. Meat is a gift. I think. Many people choose to be vegetarians voluntarily on principle. Bread for the World recommends a voluntary diet of at least 3 days a week without meat, just to identify more with the way most people in the world eat. They don't have meat. I mean, and I've been doing it for about 2 years. I mean, I eat very, very little meat and never felt better in my life. I mean, so, you know, you can, it works, I know. But that's a food habit. I think the steak and potato syndrome that, I mean, college students come to that, you know, the steak every day kind of thing practically, that seemed to be part of the American way of life, which is very unwise ecologically from the viewpoint of land use. Furthermore, it doesn't make too much sense nutritionally. Just from the cooking angle, I'm sure you know something about some of the fine cookbooks. By the way, Holden's cookbook is out. Many of you know Frances Moore LePay's Diet for a Small Planet. This is a revised edition. It's purely secular. It's sold very, very widely. It has a lot of neat recipes. Now, this is entirely high-protein, meatless cooking. High-protein, meatless cooking. And I know families that have struggled with this, and not everybody likes it to begin with, but she tried it out on her own family at work. One I really use a whole lot, the More with Less cookbook. It's put out by Mennonites. And suggestions on how to eat better and consume less of the world's limited food resources. Now, there are other cookbooks like this. They're available in the bookstore. Yes?
Oh, there's one really good one, Laurel's cookbook, that is used by nutrition classes at the University of Washington Central, I know.
All right.
Has a lot of nutrition in it.
Okay.
But I think the recipes actually taste better than many of those in the diet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I like the recipes in this better than I do in LePay's. I think LePay's was the pioneer. All right, Lark. So there are others. So I'm saying that these things are little simple things, but they are, as we're living in the glass house, maybe as we're eating more whole grains and things like that, or eating in terms of more wisely in terms of land use and so on. Maybe that's the first step. I mean, our food habits. I think that's one of the first steps. All right, the energy consumption habits I will not get into, because Rudy dealt with that yesterday and you had a chance to hear that. But I mean, that's another step that's going to be very important. Many people do not believe that fossil fuels are being limited. I mean, fossil fuels took all these millions of years to accumulate. I mean, new oil and gas may be, and coal may be being produced somewhere in the world in geological processes. But believe me, it's not going to be ready even for your grandchildren. I mean, no way. So to realize, yes, there is, our resources that way are finite, but that's Rudy's topic and I won't get into that this morning. But not only food habits and so on, but in general consumer habits. And here one of the books I think that has been most helpful, again in the bookstore, is John B. Taylor's Enough is Enough. How many of you are familiar with this? Great, all right. Augsburg now publishes it. Originally, of course, it was published in Britain because Taylor is the bishop of Winchester. Augsburg has a fine study guide. I know it's been used in our congregation for adult study groups and so on and so forth. The point of Taylor's book is it's a theological basis for moderation in a consumer-oriented society. And to recognize that this can be a cheerful revolution. We cannot go on as we are, just buying and buying, just because we can afford it, you know, we're going to buy it towards simplicity of life. And he says, first, see yourself as a citizen of the planet. See yourself as a citizen of the planet. That's that global thinking. Waste watching. Watch where you have a choice. It's in buying, resist obsolescence, it's like supporting public transport and things like that, resist wasteful packaging. Question your own lifestyle, not your neighbor's. Suggest maybe working out your way of life with the help of a group. And then happiness is knowing what I can do without. My greed is another's need, and so on. He talks about a joyful resistance movement. Consumer's resistance movement, that when you have this ad that you just have to have this new thing, that you start to ask, whom are you kidding? You know, to say you need it. Simplified lifestyle. Many of you know something about that, and we're going to share in just a minute. I was born in a house that had no indoor bathroom, no running water, no electricity. It was a teacherage out in a rural area where my father at that time was teaching, a rural school. And furthermore, the road by the house was muddy so that sometimes they couldn't get to town because the road was so muddy. I never knew I was a deprived child. By today's standards, I mean, that's deprivation. We had books. I was read to and I learned to read. We had books. We had music. Well, a little parlor organ, but both mother and dad. We had music. I was able to develop that sense of awe and wonder at the beautiful Texas starry skies without pollution at that time, you know, wildflowers, the world of nature. I had love in a Christian home. I mean, the bathroom was outdoors and sometimes it got cold, you know, whatnot. But I never knew I was deprived. Now, does this simple lifestyle mean we have to go back to that? I sure like the indoor bathroom and running water, and so on and so forth. You know, when we're talking about simplified lifestyle, it does not necessarily mean getting way out and making it from scratch. I think there's some things that sound fine, but they simply won't work for everybody. I mean, it would be neat, you know, to go out in the wilderness and start your own thing if you have the skills for it. But there are too many people and there isn't enough wilderness to do that. And to go back to that. Not everybody can do that. So we have to have different approaches to it. I resist things like I do not have a dryer. I don't have a dishwasher. I mean, I've resisted having a dishwasher, and when I have guests and so on and so forth, well, either I'll put on a record after they're gone, or they'll pitch in, or the family's there. It's a fun family time doing the dishes and so on and so forth. I don't have a clothes dryer. I have a solar dryer, a line out in the backyard. But I realize that, and I enjoy hanging clothes out in the sunshine, but I realize that my way of doing it cannot be the way of a lot of people in the city. Because a clothesline out in the city, they're going to get ripped off, or they're going to get coal dust on, or something. I mean, so again, each person in his or her situation has to work out what is a simplified lifestyle. And I'd like to now throw it out to you in response to the world situation, thinking of ourselves as global citizens, as Christian people who are concerned about our overconsumption. What kind of response do you see working in your situation? What has been your experience?
I found that as
things that have been given to me, blenders and so on, break down. You know, I just simply don't replace them anymore. And I've also found that actually it works better for me. The fewer clothes I'm buying myself and my family, the fewer toys I've got laying around the house, the fewer this and the fewer that, you know, the more convenient my life becomes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've put it to several people that way, that really it's, you know, if you can't do it for another reason, you know, do it for your own convenience and your own mm-hmm. interest. I mean, you know, the less junk you've got around the house, whether it's hanging on the walls or extra furniture or anything else, boy, the simpler your life becomes.
Do you know Emma Baumbach's writing?
Oh, yeah.
You know, the grass grows really? Greener over the septic tank. And one of the complaints in there, you know, life in suburbia is all the appliances that don't work. You know, and as you've got all these appliances and out in suburbia trying to get the repair person to come out and do it and so on and so forth. You know, it's really a very sad book. Because in the end of that, you know, suburbia where you've got all this stuff, and it's really a picture of this society where all these things, you know, all these consumer goods seem to be necessary. You remember how it ends? She says, you know, what when in the later on when you've got all these ruins and this is a wasteland, you know, and the archaeologists come dig it out and they'll wonder, you know, how did people cope with this? And she said, the voice of the ghosts who lived out here in suburbia will say, we drank.
Mm-hmm. She's really got more of a bittersweet, you know, sweet edge to her than a lot of us imagine, I think. But, you know, I was even thinking there's ways of, you know, houses and stuff like that. I was even thinking of, you know, the amounts of time that I spend cleaning the carpet and all that kind of junk. There's ways of, you know, doing that, doing away with, you know, even curtains that you wash every so often. Mm-hmm. I remember reading about, you know, a house where a woman did a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I think that's why some of us like to go camping or come to a place like this, you know, because it's everything is so nice and simple. You have all that junk that you're constantly doing all the time.
That's an attitude, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's a freeing attitude. Great. Yeah.
I like the idea in Enough is Enough about keeping a sense of humor about it, because I found myself making a few changes here and there, and then looking at the other parts of my life where I hadn't made changes in it. I get a hopeless feeling until I read that and I realized that it takes time to make changes like that. Mm-hmm. You have to keep the right perspective.
I realize that we have to do a lot of communicating because I and a few other members of the parish we belong to now, we're formerly from an inner city church where we were more involved with some of the problems of the inner city, and now we go to a church in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite different, and we've had to, I wanted to plunge right in and make them aware of some of the things that were happening, and I realized I had to go slowly, and so we now have Bread for the World and the emergency feeding program, some of those things in there, but almost some of the people are absolutely not aware of what is happening in the big cities either, and I think that we have to start to communicate these needs and things.
Yeah. Well, you know, in all these developments, every house is automatically fitted with a GE kitchen,
mm-hmm.
with all the appliances.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to move there, you haven't any choice. Either you have, you know, it's there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is, seems so ridiculous. Did you?
You get trapped in a certain situation, and you wonder how can you, you know, get out of it.
I think under those conditions, though, then you have to learn how to use them. And use them just very wisely and very,
mm-hmm.
or not use them if you choose to do so. But you have to learn to stagger your dishwashing and all of this kind of thing at a maximum kind of usage, so that you're not always constantly every time you eat or every time you have an occasion to use it that you mm-hmm. use the appliances also wisely.
Now the garbage disposal is built in at most of these. Now I don't have garbage disposal because I live in the backyard, compost.
Mm-hmm.
But now what do you do in an apartment like that where there's probably no provision for the garbage? If you would then not use the disposal, what do you do with the goop? So you really get trapped into a particular lifestyle where you live. And this is what I struggle with. That how do, as you said, how do you break out of that? And how different are you then in terms of wearing the dress, the same dress for 7 years or something like that. If it's still good, you know, wear it. Well, or for the men, you know, the tie, you know, wear the wide tie instead of the narrow tie, or whatever your shirt you wear. I mean, our style, I think our fashions force us into wastefulness of resources.
If we're going to let ourselves,
yeah. Yeah, I mean that this style is perfectly good. There's nothing wrong with this piece of clothing. Except that everybody knows that it's not this year, and you're pressed into. One thing that really turns me off is style shows sponsored by churches. I really have a bias. In fact, I wrote a piece once, which was a satire on that. Here was what the poor woman in India was wearing. Here was what the poor woman from this other village was wearing, in terms of a consciousness-raising kind of thing. I think that's pushing. I see obsolescence. Same thing with cars, of course. Yeah.
What about the excessive collection of books and records and so on? I've heard of missionaries, for instance, burn their books as they're leaving a location and just select a few to take with them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us, I think, in academic working, they can easily be inundated with.
That's an
What's
interesting question. Any reaction to that?
We should use our library.
Yes,
I've made greater use of the library. Even in now, far out in the hinterlands of Wyoming, you know,
mm-hmm.
we still have a good extension service through the Wyoming Library interchange.
But you can't get church books unless your church has a good library, or you're close to a church college or another church maybe that has a library.
That might be a good project for small
church,
so building an extremely good library.
That's right.
And encouraging people to.
Also encouraging a public library to add this kind of dimension to their resources, because they do have demand for them.
You know, there's one of those little traps, though. If your people buy books, the cost of books is going to go up. Right? The price of books is somewhat related to how many are produced, because it's cheaper to print 100,000 than it is to print, they get cheaper as you print more. So you've always got that mixed bag. Dirt?
You can always give your, if there's a book you have to have, you know, buy it, read it, and then give it to a library that you have access to, and you can always check it out while other people are using it too. We do that at the college all the time. I get a lot of free books because I review. And the minute I review the book, I put it in the college library.
I love books, but I resist adding them to my shelves. I'll read them and circulate them among a circle or something. Circulate them. Some pass them on. I mean, I think this is part of the thing, and share. Thank you for raising that, because that's the point. You know, you can accumulate anything until it gets to be a burden.
My church is building a very good library, and they also have tapes and take them out. And you
can't see.
One of the things I noticed, now I'm a clothes nut, and I'm loving it right now. Clothes and paper products and what have you. But I've noticed, okay, I got rid of a whole bunch of clothes a while back, but I didn't take them too goodwill. I took them to Tacoma and I'm purchasing foster homes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I took them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's a good option. Sure,
mm-hmm.
I'm going out there and I'm getting clothes. But the clothes that, because I go through maturing process about once a year, clothes that I don't want, I know there's going to be some kids that need clothes when they go from their home in foster care.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I noticed is, if I want an electrical appliance, I make the decision, this is the one I want.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want I don't want a mixer, toaster I got was given to me.
Mm-hmm.
I made a decision for a new hair dryer. Mostly because my hair is so, but making that kind of conscious decision that I don't want new things. Who says we have to have new furniture?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On the appliance bit, I don't know whether it's Taylor or somebody, one of the many books, suggests young families sharing a major appliance. I mean, if they're living in close proximity. I mean, like if it's a lawnmower or something like that, why does everybody have to have a lawnmower and people in a neighborhood? But the trouble is usually we're not neighborhoods where we know our neighbors, but where it's possible. Joni, do you all do any of that? Would you tell us a little bit about your Chicago situation?
Well, our living situation is a collective building that we own in common with some other folks, friends and close relatives, and it's a building with seven apartments in it, seven family units, so that there's some clear privacy. But we try to own a lot of things in common. So we have seven units using, you know, one washer dryer kind of setup, and we share a car when we need to. There are some advantages in terms of simplified lifestyle in the city. Obvious one is public transportation. Plus the access to all of the kinds of stimuli in a city that you really have to, I mean, you don't need records in a city because you've got 5,000 FM stations on your little block radio, you know, that you can deal with. So there's a whole lot of free public stuff in the city that you can take advantage of. So we just try to we eat together some. The house doesn't eat much meat, if any, and we share all of the stuff we can possibly share, both internally in the building and with whatever neighbors we can get to do that with. It's not simple, it's not perfect, there are a lot of compromises. Owning things in common is always a hassle, but not, I think, not as much of a hassle as owning it individually. All you have to do is to make sure you've got an hour or two a week to sit down with people and say, okay, what's happening now? What, you know, who's feeling bad about how this, that, or the other thing is being used, and how do we work it out? If there's a willingness to work it out, I think it works. And we certainly feel anything but deprived. We live comfortable middle-class lives on not very much money.
There's some great resources on this kind of thing. Some of you may know John and Mary Schramm's Things That Make for Peace. Now, they, of course, have worked out on their farm in West Virginia. Not everybody can do it on the farm setting. One of the very helpful, practical ones comes out of the Quaker community in San Francisco, Taking Charge. And this has some real neat things. If you're into creative simplicity, for example, about clothing, using energy and living simply, about a whole lot about food and community, building community, personal growth, and so on, with the introduction, the first right is, you know, consuming the world. I mean, recognizing that our overconsumption. So there are just a lot of very good helps to raise your own consciousness about simplifying lifestyle. I think this has to be the first response. I think the second response has to be political, in terms of being involved with groups where we're informed about, like through Bread for the World, Impact, or something like that, the work of multinational corporations, maybe writing letters and so on. But I think the first step is in our own homes, our own family. I'd like to summarize, because I don't like to keep you more than an hour, but we can continue this if you wish, but we'll conclude formally with some excerpts from something that was done by Jorgen Lissner, who is Secretary for Peace, Justice, and Human Rights of the Lutheran World Federation. He has these 10 reasons for choosing a simpler lifestyle. Now, some of these are overlap with what Taylor and other people said, but how many of you are familiar with this list of 10 reasons? I think it's one of the best summaries of this. And he has today's global realities call for comfortable Christians to review their lifestyle. You cannot lay down universal rules. They must be developed by individuals and communities according to their own imagination and situation. What works for Jody and Ingrid in Chicago isn't going to be your setting or my setting in Seguin or whatever, so it has to be individual. A simpler lifestyle is not a panacea. It's not going to solve all the problems. Because I live more simply, it may not help people in Colombia eat any better. I mean, you've got to recognize that. It may be embarked upon for the wrong reasons, out of guilt. You know, I just sort of castigate myself, you know, so it makes me a little holier. Or as a substitute for political action. It should never do that. But it can also be meaningful and significant in some or all of the following ways. One is as an act of faith performed for the sake of personal integrity and as an expression of a personal commitment to a more equitable distribution of the world's resources. It's an act of faith. As an act of self-defense against the mind and body polluting effects of overconsumption. You just get so crowded with all this stuff that you just, you know, you want to clean it out. You know, I'm going to buy one more thing. I mean, you give it away, that guy. Overconsumption. As an act of withdrawal from the achievement neurosis of our high-pressure materialist societies. I do know young families in my congregation who are caught in this trap of moving to bigger houses. They had a neat little house. It wasn't bad, I thought, sort of. But here's a newer neighborhood, which has a little nicer neighborhood, bigger house. So they get caught in this achievement neurosis, go deeper and deeper into debt, because this is where more of the people are moving. You know people like that? Mm-hmm. You know, so it's an achievement neurosis. As an act of solidarity with the majority of humankind, which has no choice about lifestyle. As an act of sharing with others what has been given to us. Obviously, if you don't live as high on the hog, you might have a little bit more to give to causes that help other people. As an act of celebration of the riches found in creativity, spirituality, and community with others, rather than in mindless materialism. Someone pointed out the note of joy, the sense of humor. Taylor says that as a celebration, a joyous revolt of consumers. You can be creative about it. Hey, I don't need to do this. This is more fun to do anyway this way. As an act of provocation, ostentatious under consumption. Well, maybe don't do push that too far, but it may arouse curiosity. I have had dinner parties where I've deliberately made it meatless. Mm-hmm. And then handed them bread for the world. Something like that. I mean, yeah, and you try it on your friends. There are others as an exercise of purchasing power. You know, we are consumers. We are powerful. We insist on having all these gadgets and stuff that really don't help, but they just consume energy. I mean, here's our power. All right. So Taylor also says as an act of anticipation for the era when it may be different. The changes are coming. We're going to be forced to change our lifestyle one way or the other.